This is Conor Lennon from UN News. As the UN's first ever victims' rights advocate, Jane Connors has to confront an uncomfortable reality. Sexual abuse and exploitation, or SEA for short, carried out by UN personnel. Her most recent report detailed 80 SEA cases at peacekeeping and political missions in 2019 and 95 allegations recorded at other UN entities. 3 years on from the start of her mandate, which began in September 2017, I spoke to Ms. Connors, who said that, since then, it's become more apparent that the ongoing issue of sexual abuse and exploitation goes well beyond the peacekeeping sector.
We saw in 2018, the early part, the allegations relating to Oxfam in Haiti, which made it clear that humanitarians engage in this behaviour. I think there's been a big movement. I don't know how much. I mean, it's very difficult to assess yourself in terms of achievements, but I think the understanding that we have a system-wide problem, well, it's more than a problem, and that a victim's rights approach has to be taken system-wide, I think that's now understood. The implementation is more complicated, but we're moving in the right direction.
These victims, their trust has been abused. The trust in the United Nations has been abused. How then is it possible for you to convince victims that you, as the rights advocate, the field rights advocate, your team, are people that can be trusted?
The field victims' rights advocates, they are individuals who are able to generate trust. And certainly, where abuse is concerned, definitely, and sexual exploitation also, definitely this affects trust in the organisation. But at the same time, there is a little bit of research on what people feel, even in the context where there's been abuse and exploitation. They do feel that the United Nations has more to offer in very difficult situations than even in contexts where trust has been abused to a high extent. But in the context of the work of the field victims' rights advocates, they spend a lot of time with what we describe as community-based complaints networks. In other words, with community structures, which are more or less comprised of leaders of various contexts, the police, the religious bodies, children's rights bodies, women's rights bodies, etc. And they engage with a lot of capacity building, information sharing and things of that nature. And they also make it clear that they are available to have complaints brought to them. And more than that, they do concrete things in order to deal with the issues that confront victims. And in general terms, what they're interested in is medical attention, psychological care, ways to put them in a position where they can gain livelihoods. And if they have children born of sexual exploitation and abuse, they really want to see efforts, real efforts put in place so that the parental responsibility of the father of the child is brought to bear. And that's really does rebuild trust in an enormous way. Just small things. I mean, they're not really that small if you're the person involved. One of my field victims' rights advocates recently worked with the Ministry of Women in one of the countries to ensure that bank accounts could be established for women with successful claims relating to the fathers of their children. And that's difficult. You see, we fail to remember that there are practical things. You can't get remittances if you don't have a bank account. You can't get a bank account if you don't have a job. So it's those nitty-gritty little things that really go a long way to rebuild trust. I've seen it happen. I went to, an example I can give you is I went to Haiti in April 2018. I met with the women with the children who have unresolved paternity claims. It was an uncomfortable meeting, as you could imagine, and they were very forthright. They said, "We've seen people like you before. You come, you talk to us, you tell us all these wonderful things, then you go away, we hear nothing." And I said to them, "Well, what would make things different for you? And they talked about the fact that their kids couldn't go to school. And I said, well, I can't promise anything, but I will do my best. And I was able, with the help of the Feel Victims' Rights Advocate there at the time, he's moved on now, to get a little bit of money pulled together, which supported school fees and school supplies for these children. And apparently the Feel Victims' Rights Advocate met with these women at the end of 2018, and they said to him she kept her promise. It just makes a big difference. I mean, they're the things that really work. A small step can rebuild trust to a great extent.
And what kind of collaboration are you getting from member states, from the countries contributing the troops, some of whom have committed these abuses? I mean, this is clearly a very important part of facilitating paternity tests, making sure there's accountability. How's that going?
It will depend on the relevant member state, but there have been some very encouraging steps forward with regard to several member states, in particular with regard to paternity claims. This is, I really do focus on, I mean, accountability generally is something that I do focus on, but within that context, I focus on what is spoken of more by the victims, and that is the issue of the support that the father should give to a child born of sexual exploitation and abuse. So I've put a big focus on that, and there are encouraging signs with regard to some states. We had a very interesting webinar or meeting with member states about 3 weeks ago, where South Africa talked about the steps it's taking with respect to some of its troops with regard to paternity claims. So the signs are encouraging. And when you have one or two states who step forward, that creates an interest in other states who don't want to be left behind, so to speak. And in view of that, we are convening with the Conduct and Discipline Service. I am convening a working level meeting next year on resolution of paternity claims with member states, and hopefully we'll be able to develop a sort of more coherent roadmap with regard to the way forward. But all I can say is the signs are encouraging. I suppose I'm an unusual UN staff member. I always say things are encouraging rather than brilliant. And it is a process. It's bringing everybody along. But if you have some states who are going forward, that will really encourage others.
Now, this, of course, should never happen, sexual exploitation abuse by anyone, but particularly the people who are supposed to be the protectors. Do you think now, after 3 years, this is something that can be stopped, or is it really just a question of mitigating this issue?
As a UN staff member, this behaviour is very hurt. Is very hurtful to the victims, obviously, to communities, flies in the face of what we're supposed to be doing. And of course, it hurts other staff members who feel they feel that this is just a betrayal of all of the ideals of our 75 years of age organization. I don't think that the behaviour is inevitable, and accordingly, I think that the behaviour is behaviour that can be stopped. I think we have various levels of perpetrators. However, some may well be perpetrators, you know, sort of bound to perpetrate, if you know what I mean. But often it's a matter of differential power, extreme vulnerability, situations of extreme vulnerability and opportunity. So I think the issue of the power imbalance is something that certainly we can deal with. Addressing the whole culture of exploitation and moving into that abuse is something we can do, but it needs a lot of work, and it needs consistent work. We can see that it's possible to change behaviour. It may be more difficult to change attitudes, but I think certainly from my point of view, the behaviour can be stopped. I do see very good examples. I saw in one of my visits the work of a police commissioner who had put in place various in a particular context where the police had engaged in police from the police contributing countries had engaged in a lot of sexual exploitation and abuse. He'd brought it right down by really paying attention to mitigation measures, looking at early warning, just continually raising consciousness of the total unacceptability of the behaviour, and this had worked. The numbers had definitely come down. So things can be done. And of course, the basic issue is that we're working in contexts where those who do become subject to this conduct are often in a very, they're often considered, the contextual consideration of women and children in some of these contexts is pretty bad also. So they have the legal framework, the policy framework doesn't necessarily, won't put women and children on the same level as men. The behaviour which is engaged in by UN personnel might be tolerated in the broader community. It requires a lot of work, and not just in an isolated way, but also dealing with the challenges that confront those who are in extremely vulnerable situations in the countries where we operate.